Why don't you just take a minute, say hello to somebody around you. Let's all respect one another's personal space as appropriate, but say hi. So again, welcome to Cedar Ridge. I'm Matthew, I'm the lead pastor here. And welcome to everybody on Zoom. Thanks for joining us. We're in a series at the moment on the Gospel of Luke, and we looked at the first part of that book from the Christian scriptures at the beginning of the year. We looked at how Jesus was moving around his home region of Galilee, teaching and challenging and encouraging, and we called that one the good news for everyone, because Jesus was so inclusive. And then this series, which is the second part of Luke, we've called it A New Kind of Kingdom. Because Jesus was talking about a new way of living, a new way of life, a new power, if you like, that isn't based actually on oppression or manipulation, but on love. And we saw in the first week the kingdom of inclusivity, if you like, in that everyone is included in the kingdom. In fact, the only reason not to be included is if you choose not to be included, if you don't want to be part of that way, if you choose you're choosing a different kind of program, a program perhaps of power, or you want to be with the people who have the power. And then last week, Ruth was talking about a kingdom, an upside down kingdom, a kingdom that is only seen and perhaps recognized and accepted by people who have the least to lose. And the challenge of when you've got lots of stuff, or when you've got lots of power, or you have a lot of control over your life, it's easy to miss this new kind of kingdom that Jesus is talking about. And so Jesus is with people from the margins, people on the bottom, people who have been oppressed, people who've had a hard time of life very often. Today, we're going to talk about kingdoms in conflict, because as Jesus has been progressing through the story of that the author of Luke tells, he sets his face towards Jerusalem. He heads out towards Jerusalem. And there's some kind of foreboding about that, because Jesus comes in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets, and Jesus himself says Jerusalem is where those prophets get killed. And he knows he's going to Jerusalem at one level because he's going to celebrate the Passover. But the Passover is a festival celebrating the Exodus, the liberation of the people of Israel. And Jesus is bringing a different kind of liberation, a liberation not just for an individual set of people or a particular country, but for the whole world. And Jesus is going to deal with this human issue. He's dealing with the human issue of love versus fear. And he knows, I think we get the impression that Jesus knows that this new kind of kingdom he's bringing is going to be rejected. And he very likely will himself face death in Jerusalem, just like the prophets that went before him have done. So there's this sense of foreboding. And in this section that we're going to look at today, it's Luke chapter 19 through to 22, there's this sadness, I think, that hangs over the whole passage. It begins with some sadness, which we'll look at briefly, and it ends with sadness. It ends with Judas betraying Jesus. And so this sadness prevails through. And obviously next week, we're going to talk about the death of Jesus, and sadness will prevail there. But in all that sadness, as I've been looking at these stories again, I'm just so amazed at Jesus. I feel like I love Jesus even more looking at Jesus in these passages, because Jesus is so courageous, so true, so real, even in the context of the sadness. And he doesn't pretend that the sadness isn't there. He doesn't pretend that the difficulties aren't there or the suffering's not there. He embraces it all. And I hope you feel the same way at the end of this, that I can't help but love Jesus even more. I also feel I'm so far from that. I'm so far from where Jesus is at. So that's incredibly challenging to me. But at the same time, I don't feel condemned. I don't feel belittled. I feel invited into something that is challenging and difficult, but so worthwhile, so worth it. And in fact, it's an invitation, not just into a new kind of kingdom that we benefit from, but rather an invitation into an opportunity to save the world. That's sort of a bit of a big statement, but I think that's what Jesus is doing. When Jesus is coming to save the world, not just to forgive individual people of their sins so that God will like you now. I mean, that seems so small for a God of love, but rather to deal with the human condition, to deal with the very things that create all the hell that we live in today, and human beings have been living in for millennia, and especially so back in the time of Jesus, that Jesus has come to heal humanity. And that's just incredible. So let's look at what's in this passage. We have the section where Jesus enters Jerusalem and cleanses the temple. We're probably fairly familiar with that. We celebrate it every Palm Sunday. Then Jesus' credibility, his authority is challenged, not surprisingly. He tells a parable that sort of illustrates this change in authority that's taking place from and this new kind of kingdom. There's a question that Jesus asks. He also gives a warning, and he shows an example of what's really going on. There's a sort of an unveiling, a revealing of what's going on in the religious culture of the day. And then there's an apocalyptic passage, which we're going to look at. It's a tricky passage. Wait and see what that holds. And then Judas sets Jesus up. Judas doesn't actually betray Jesus in this section. That happens next week. But we're told that Judas is going to set Jesus up. And he's kind of given up on Jesus. It's tragic. It's just that whole sadness that I was talking about. Okay, let's jump into the first one of those. If we keep that list up first, we'll jump into the first one where Jesus comes into Jerusalem. Now, again, we've talked about this before. We do it every Palm Sunday, and being really honest, and I'm sure Ruth would agree with this, that Palm Sunday comes around every year, and you're trying to take a different angle on Palm Sunday, right? So it's always a little bit of a challenge when Palm Sunday comes around, because it's the same story each time. But Jesus, basically, I think we're probably familiar with it, comes into Jerusalem. It's a mixture of celebration, but also some sadness. It's sometimes called the triumphal entry, but it's also not all that triumphant, because Jesus, yes, comes in as like the messianic king. You know, people lay their coats down. In some gospels, it says they lay palm branches down. Jesus comes in on a donkey, which is fulfilling a certain prophecy about how the Messiah is going to come into Jerusalem. So Jesus comes in many respects as the king, but Jesus also enters from the Mount of Olives through the sheep gate, the eastern gate, which is the gate that the sacrificial lambs would have been brought through into the temple for potential sacrifice. They'd be taken in by shepherds and then examined in the temple to make sure that they were spotless, that they were perfect lambs. And we know that Jesus is coming through that gate as a sacrificial lamb, probably going to his death, and he's going to be interrogated. He's going to be investigated. He's going to be checked out to make sure, is he really who he says he is? Is he spotless, if you like? So there's, again, that sort of sense of sadness over even this apparently triumphal entry. Also at the same time, roughly that time of year, because remember, this is the Passover, or coming up to the Passover, Jerusalem would have swollen to three times its normal size because of all the pilgrims coming in to celebrate. And so the Romans were very anxious about that. Numbers, they're worried about. And also the fact that, okay, this is a festival celebrating liberation from tyranny. So we better bring in reinforcements. And there would have been a show of force coming through the Western Gate, led by Pilate, just to make sure that everybody knows who's in charge here and you know where the power lies. So, and Jesus is in complete contrast to that. So now Jesus then goes, and we're not sure of the exact timing, but after entering Jerusalem, goes and cleanses the temple, right? Let's see what it says here in Luke's account of it. It's a very short account about cleansing the temple in Luke. When Jesus entered the temple courts, he began to drive out those who were selling. It is written, he said to them, my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. Every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because the people hung on his words. So Jesus is popular with the masses at this point, but the religious authorities already, we're finding out, he's only just got to Jerusalem. They want to kill him. Now this is the other gospels go into a little bit more detail about Jesus cleansing the temple. Here it just says Jesus throws out those, and that term in the Greek, throws out, is the same term that is used for when Jesus drives out demons or casts out demons. Ekbalo is the word. And it says he throws out those who were selling. It just says, in the Greek, it's paleo. It's just sellers, barterers. And you almost wonder if the author of Luke is having a little dig here. There's a little bit of innuendo, because he's not specific about money changers or who those sellers are. but the religious authorities, that they're buying, selling religion, they're peddling religion, they're manipulating religion for their own ends, sometimes financially, sometimes just power and authority and a sense of perhaps well-being and I'm a good person. But it's buying and selling. And Jesus has come to rid Judaism of that. Perhaps that's what the author is inferring there. But we don't get too much detail on it. But the fact that this is in all four Gospels, to me, that shows this was a very significant event. You can imagine people later on when they're recounting stories, which eventually resulted in stories being written down and becoming scripture. When they're recounting those stories, imagine going like, wow, do you remember that time when Jesus went into the table and into the temple and did such and such? And you know, wasn't that incredible? And so it seems to have captured the imagination of the early followers of Jesus, certainly. And what we see here is Jesus taking the conflict to the authorities. I mean, and so as we think about kingdoms in conflict, the way of love against the way of power and fear and power and control. When we think about this conflict, it's interesting to say that it's not a conflict that's passive. Jesus is not passive in this conflict whatsoever. The conflict's being redrawn somewhat. Formerly, it was with the Pharisees, right? As Jesus is out in the rural areas where the synagogues prevail and the Pharisees are the religious authorities, that was one set of conflict. Now he's in Jerusalem. He's in conflict with the temple system, the high priest system, which have inevitable political power as well, and are in cahoots with the Roman political power. So this is a different kind of power. These are people that can kill him, that can exercise a whole load more authority, even if the people don't want them to do that. They have clout, and Jesus is now in conflict with them, but he's taken the conflict to them. It's not passivity. And you know, I think we need to, we're going to explore this a little bit, that this way of love inevitably causes conflict. It inevitably causes conflict. So the way of love is not the absence of conflict. The way of peace is not the absence of conflict. But the conflict is always loving. Jesus never lets go of love, never turns this into a vengeful conflict or another set of powers to overcome and manipulate and control people. It's not about now it's okay to hate the bad people. Jesus is always about love. And we see this, I think, in a little few verses between Jesus going into Jerusalem and cleansing the temple. Here, we'll go back a little bit. Here's what it says. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come when you and your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." So as Jesus approaches Jerusalem, and remember, we left Jesus last week in Jericho with Zacchaeus, and the entourage has now moved on to Jerusalem. Now, Jericho is about 850 feet below sea level. It's not too far from the Dead Sea. It's the lowest city on earth, in fact. And it's about 25 miles away is Jerusalem, and you have to go up to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is, I think, 2,500 or so feet above sea level. I mean, it's not super high, but it's way higher than Jericho. So that's why they say, go up to Jerusalem. Jesus is always saying, I must go up to Jerusalem, because it's higher. And so you can imagine that this entourage has been on this winding, dusty, hot road for 25 miles, gradually ascending until they get to the Mount of Olives, which is just east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives is separated from Jerusalem, which is on another hill. The Mount of Olives is, again, about 2,600 or so feet above sea level. So they got up to this peak, and then you can see Jerusalem. And you imagine, and I think perhaps Luke is alluding to this, the sense of expectation. They're on their way to Jerusalem. And then finally, they get to the top of the Mount of Olives. They look across the Kidron Valley, and there is Jerusalem. And Jesus' reaction is to break down and cry. And it begs the question, why is Jesus crying? I think Jesus is sad. I think Jesus is probably afraid, to be honest. He knows what he's getting into. It's not wrong to be afraid. It's wrong to live your life based on fear. But we all get afraid. There's times when we should be afraid. Maybe it's disappointment, all this work, all this effort, all this touring around, trying to persuade people about life and the opportunity for a new kind of kingdom, and it's going to be rejected. All of those things are probably valid, but I think primarily Jesus is weeping because of love. He loves the city. He loves the people. Jesus loves his enemies, and he's looking ahead like a classic Hebrew prophet and saying, I don't think Jesus is predicting the future like he's had secret knowledge about the future, because what he's describing here, and he describes it later, is the fall of Jerusalem, that Jerusalem will eventually, in 70 CE, so you know, a few decades later, Jerusalem will be destroyed by the Romans and the temple will be destroyed. That happened historically. Jesus seems to be looking at the city and saying, you're rejecting this way of peace, you're rejecting this way of love, and that will perpetuate the cycle of violence, and that cycle of violence will come back and destroy you. I think Jesus is saying that's what the future holds. It's inevitable unless you accept this new way, unless we can get to the root of things and deal with the issues of the heart, the human condition. This is inevitable. And he's heartbroken. He sobs as he looks over the city. There's a little depiction from a 19th century painting here of Jesus looking out. I was trying to look for some present day photos of that view from the Mount of Olives over Jerusalem. Couldn't really find anything. So there's this sadness, but it's all about love. Now let's go back to our list of what's going on. The next section has Jesus's credibility being challenged, and he tells a parable about the tenants. Now, not surprising that Jesus's credibility is challenged at this point, right? He's gone in and sort of taken the conflict to the religious authorities by going into the temple, and then he starts hanging out in the temple. He spends pretty much his whole time in the temple, and then at night times he goes back to the Mount of Olives and has a bit of quiet time with his close followers, and then comes back into the temple again early in the morning. So he's not avoiding anybody. And so we get this story where the religious authorities come and challenge him. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the good news, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things?" they said. "Who gave you this authority?" He replied, "I will also ask you a question. Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin?" They discussed it among themselves and said, "If we say from heaven, he will ask, why didn't you believe him? If we say of human origin, all the people will stone us because they are persuaded that John was a prophet." So they answered, "We don't know where it was from." Jesus said, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things." So here's tricksy Jesus, perhaps. Right. So, you know, when we read this at first sight, it seems like Jesus is just being a bit contrary, nitpicking or whatever. And he doesn't want to answer the question, so he'll tell them a difficult question instead. But there's a lot more going on in the passage than that. Firstly, leaders, didn't you notice there was three sets of leaders? The temple priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. It's like they this is a show of power, a show of strength. They all show up and say, "What the heck do you think you're doing? And by what authority do you do it? Who do you think you are?" is essentially what they're asking here. And so Jesus responds with a question which is all about authority, because he references John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist, we've almost forgotten about John the Baptist by this part in the story. But Luke places John the Baptist in a very high place in his gospel. Because if you think about it, John the Baptist gets, a good, I don't know if it's a whole chapter, but a lot of narrative right at the beginning about his birth, which is, we get the birth story of Jesus in the gospels, but not really, we don't get birth stories about other people, but we get a birth story for John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is the one who baptizes Jesus and who points to Jesus as the Messiah. When John baptizes Jesus, there's that voice that people hear where it's like, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." So that's where Jesus's authority comes from. And it's almost like the Hebrew tradition of anointing kings. Kings would be anointed by a prophet. And it's as though John's anointing of Jesus at baptism is a sign of God's, a blessing, a sign that Jesus is from God, that Jesus has that authority. So he's asking them that question. Now, they hear what we get in response is they don't want to commit either way for obvious reasons. The text tells us that, which just goes, they're buying and selling religion, right? They're afraid of the people. They're very angry and very afraid, which is a lethal combination. But they're not going to commit either way because that's the kind of business they're in. They're not about the truth. They're not about what's right. They're about what's expedient in any given moment. And they're afraid of the people because Jesus seems to, and John the Baptist had a following, and Jesus knows that. he gets it. So he's putting them in a really awkward position, which kind of exposes their hypocrisy. And then he's saying, well, look, if you don't recognize, if you're not prepared to commit about John, then you know, I'm not going to commit about giving you a response about my authority because that's where it's come from. You just don't want to admit it. You don't want to, you don't see it. You don't understand it. And he kind of flips the conflict around. Now, he goes then on to tell a story that we looked at, or a parable that we looked at a few weeks ago. So we're not going to jump into that. It's a parable about the tenants, a vineyard, which represents the people of Israel, tenants, which represent the religious authorities, an owner of that vineyard who's God, and the owner's son who represents Jesus, who is sent to sort the vineyard out, make it more fruitful, and they kill the son. And it's clear from that parable that Jesus is saying, look, this old order based on power, manipulation, control, this order based on fear, is not bearing fruit. It's producing bad fruit, and that change is coming, and there's a new kind of kingdom, and I'm bringing that new kind of kingdom. And they are absolutely furious. They get it totally. It's not one of those more subtle esoteric parables. It's pretty blunt, and they get it. And in the next scripture, it says the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them, but they were afraid of the people. Again, they're afraid. But everything's based on fear. We get this, they're manipulating and controlling and trying to trick Jesus and trying to catch him out in all sorts of different ways. But they're afraid. It's all based on fear. It's all based on control or an attempt to have control based on power. And Jesus is, at some level, kind of running rings around them, and they don't really know what to do about it. Let's go back to our little list. So we move on here to Jesus now. He leads with a question. He's got a warning for them, and he shows an example. Now, there's some parts we're going to miss out here, but as I mentioned, they're constantly asking questions. They're spying on him, it says. They're watching him closely. They give him tricky questions that could get him into trouble, and Jesus is getting out of them. And he kind of turns the tables at this point and asks a question. Let's look at what the question is. Then Jesus said to them, why is it said that the Messiah is the son of David? They would have all agreed with that. That was the Messiah is going to be a descendant of David. David himself declares in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. David calls him Lord. How then can he be his son? What Jesus seems to be saying here, And we don't get a response at this point. But what Jesus seems to be saying is, look, the Messiah is viewed as being a human leader. You know, they were hoping for a mighty king, somebody who with great human strength, who could deliver them from oppression and lead them into a new golden age, like David led, a so-called golden age, let's say. But Jesus is saying, look, the Messiah is actually not just going to be the son of David, but the son of God, or the embodiment of God. The Messiah will be full of God. And you are looking at the Messiah. You are looking at someone who is full of God, and you don't recognize God because God is vulnerable. God is loving. God is not controlling. God is not condemning. But you have a different view of God, and you can't see that. I'm revealing, it's been revealed to you, but you can't see it. And then he goes on and talks about more revealing when he says to the people, while all the people were listening, Jesus said to his disciples, beware of the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses. For a show they make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely. So here Jesus is again saying, look, okay, so you don't recognize me. You're not expecting, appearances can be deceptive, right? Turns out God is not the way you thought God was. And likewise, appearances can be deceptive. You can have all the trappings of religion, all the trappings of being good, but if you're using that religion or using that power, or using that influence, using that privilege for your own ends, to either abuse people or manipulate people, as implied in this statement, or just for your own benefit. In other words, religion, spirituality is really a selfish thing. It's for our own benefit, to help ourselves and give ourselves a better life. If that's what it's about, then that's hypocrisy. He's revealing the hypocrisy of the religious order. He then goes on in the next part to say how appearances can be deceptive in the opposite way. As Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. Remember, he's in the temple. That's where he's hanging out at this point. He also saw a poor widow put in two very small copper coins. Truly, I tell you, he said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. Now, very often, we look to this passage as a passage about the incredible sacrificial giving of the widow. I think Jesus, he's not against the widow, but rather than lauding the widow, I think he's saying, this is crazy. Here's somebody who has virtually no money, who, because of the pressure she's under for forgiveness or to be right with God or to be in good standing with the religious authorities, is putting her money in, faithfully hoping that this is going to accomplish something, while rich people just throw in a little fraction of their wealth and feel good about themselves. Jesus is saying, look, the oppressed, the lowly, the people with least to lose, they're actually the precious ones. They're people who are closer to the heart of God than people who have very little to lose, even though they can probably give more. Appearances can be deceptive. It's as though Jesus is peeling off the veneer of the culture of the day, which is so wrapped up in religion in that culture. He's peeling off this veneer and letting people see what's real, what is true, what reality is. And that leads into the next passage, which is an apocalyptic passage. It's a difficult passage. We're going to read it in a moment. Jesse's going to come up and read it to us. It's a sort of passage that I'd rather not talk about because it's tricky. It's tricky to put it into context for us, but we're not going to avoid it. We're going to look at this whole section. Apocalypse means unveiling. It's the last book of the Christian scriptures. It's called Revelation because the first word in the book is apocalypsis, which can be translated revelation or unveiling. And it's apocalypse. Apocalyptic literature is dramatic, poetic, visionary, dreamlike imagery that reveals things to us about what's really real. So let's listen to this passage as Jesse reads it to us, and then we'll just unpack it a little bit before we wrap up.
Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Teacher, they asked, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place? He replied, watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name claiming I am he, and the time is near. Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and uprisings, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilences in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will seize you and persecute you. They will hand you over to synagogues and put you in prison, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. And so you will bear testimony to me. But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves. For I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You will be betrayed even by parents, brothers and sisters, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. Everyone will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. Stand firm and you will win life. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment and fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. He told them this parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they sprout leaves, you can see for yourself and know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Be careful, or your hearts will be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the anxieties of life, and that day will close on you suddenly like a trap. For it will come on all those who live on the face of the whole earth. Be always on the watch and pray that you may be able to escape all that is about to happen, and that you may be able to stand before the Son of Man.
Each day Jesus was teaching at the temple, and each evening he went out to spend the night on the hill called the Mount of Olives, and all the people came early in the morning to hear him at the temple. So they still want to listen to Jesus even after that message. And as I said, this is a tricky passage. It's apocalyptic literature, and there was a lot of apocalyptic literature around at that time. We're not so familiar with it. It's somewhat alien to us. Sounds like extreme and intense, which it really is. But it's not clear. Did Jesus go into apocalyptic mode here himself? Some people think of Jesus as an apocalyptic figure. Or is the author of Luke using the apocalyptic genre to illustrate some of the things that Jesus was talking about? We're not sure about that, obviously. But let's just take it here at face value. So let's break this down a little bit, because there's a long section and I think can be a troubling one. So it's in an apocalyptic genre. That's dreamlike, visionary language, extreme hyperbolic language. Like in this, we may have heard there, everyone will hate you. That's the sort of language of the apocalypse. It's extreme hyperbolic language, very poetic. So in this instance, we get lots of signs in the sky, right? You know, the raging seas, the sun will be blotted out, the moon will be blotted out. So we think of solar eclipses and lunar eclipses and meteor showers and things like that. Back in the ancient world, were viewed as signs. There's signs of what's going on. And apocalyptic literature is full of that, but it represents religious, political, and social upheaval. And Jesus is talking about that quite explicitly as well. Nation will rise up against nation. There'll be wars and rumors of wars. He's saying that a time is coming. This is inevitable. It's like Jesus stood looking over Jerusalem and weeping. It's the cycle of violence is going to be perpetuated, and it's not going to be good. It's not going to be a situation you want to be in. In fact, you ought to pray that you would escape it. There's going to be such upheaval that Jerusalem will be destroyed and the temple will be destroyed. He's very explicit about that, very explicit in this section. And he talked about persecution. And he's saying to his followers, you will be persecuted. People will hate you. Even family members will hate you. Jesus seems to be looking ahead to a time when the early church was terribly persecuted. It's interesting, it says synagogues and prisons. So the early followers of Jesus were persecuted by the synagogue. They were like a sect within Judaism, but they were thrown out of the synagogue and very often persecuted for several reasons, but because of heresy, but also because They were talking about a new world order, which religious authorities were afraid would provoke the Romans. It's because they were the world order, you know, and we don't want to, we're in cahoots with them. We've got things sorted out. We can manage that. Don't mess it up. And then the Romans themselves, not just throwing people into prisons, but under the persecution of Nero. So, you know, Rome burns in 64 CE and Nero blames it on the Christians. And there's this terrible persecution of the Christians. And then the eventual, as I say, in 70 CE, the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. And Jesus is talking about all this stuff because he's predicting the future because it's inevitable in Jesus's way. Now, maybe Jesus has insight into specifically what's going to happen, but it's interesting that he uses all this poetic apocalyptic language. And that, as I mentioned, was because there's lots of apocalyptic literature around at that time, particularly that references the Son of Man, the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds. You sort of imagine visually sort of what's that look like? Jesus sort of surfing in on a cloud, or the Son of Man surfing in on a cloud. But the point of the Son of Man was that in the concurrent literature of the time, the apocalyptic literature of the time, the Son of Man came to deal out death and judgment. The Son of Man came to judge the Gentiles in favor of the people of Israel. And finally defeat them. But Jesus sort of flips this around. He's referring to something that they know about, but he's just talking about the Son of Man coming. There's no death or vengeance. He's in fact saying to them, don't give up. Don't give up on the way of love. In other words, I think what Jesus is getting at here is, and his reference to the Son of Man is like, the Son of Man is not going to come to with more violence, just a better kind of violence or good violence or, you know, good hatred or something like that. No, Jesus is saying, look, the Son of Man is coming. I'm going to be with you. He's putting himself in that place of the Son of Man. I'm going to be with you. Don't give up. Don't give up on this way. Because it's not like it's going to all happen in your lifetime. He's saying these things will happen in your generation. So he's not talking about the end of the world. Sometimes this is interpreted as, you know, the end times and the end of the world. Well, Jesus is saying, look, this is going to happen within this generation. And I think that's pretty accurate based on the time frame I was talking about. But what's going to happen is this way of love has to persevere. This way of love isn't just going to make everything okay immediately. It's a little bit like we were talking about a few weeks ago about hope. It's about living in the moment and doing the right thing, doing the loving thing in the moment, even though all around us may seem calamitous and dark and deadly. And even when all around us, people are not living the way of love. People are not in line with that. And we're at great risk by continuing to live that way. And these, I mean, we think times are difficult now, right? We feel like we're in really difficult circumstances in the world, in our nation. And that's true. But compared with what these people were going through a few decades later, if Jesus is saying that to them, I would imagine Jesus is saying that to us now. Don't give up. Don't give up on the way of love. Don't resort to violence. Don't resort to revenge. Don't resort to hatred. Don't resort to just a different kind of oppression. I've come to bring a whole new kind of kingdom. And this is immediately followed by Judas betraying Jesus. If we go back to our original list, we've got Judas sets Jesus up. And you can imagine Judas thinking, this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. Take charge now. If that's going to happen, take charge now. Don't let all that suffering happen. Don't let our enemies win the day. Don't let the temple be destroyed. They're not anti-temple. They're not anti-Judaism. They're within that movement. They want renewal. They want things to be better. So seize power. Even if you have to do a little bit of power and control and a little bit of fear-mongering and a little bit of violence, it's for the greater good. And you can sympathize to some extent with Judas. We vilified Judas, right? Judas is the betrayer. He's an icon in our culture. But how many of us have not at some time thought, why don't we just bomb Putin? Why don't we just get our own back on? Why don't we just stop these crazy people doing these crazy things? What single one of us has not had a hateful, violent response well up in all manner of situations? Maybe watching the hearings, last Thursday. Maybe, I mean, you name it. We've all got different things that get us up and tempt us, I think, to let go of the way of love and pursue something that could, it's all well-intentioned. But Jesus is saying, that's just going to perpetuate the cycle of violence. I've come to do something so much bigger than just solve this immediate problem right now. I've come to bring life. I've come to bring a new kind of kingdom. I've come to bring healing and reconciliation to all of humanity. And it's not just going to happen like that. It's going to take people like you and me, people who perhaps feel they haven't got what it takes, just refusing to give up and to keep going, to never give up. So let's look at some ways we can apply what we're seeing in this section. And I've called this, you know, it's a new kind of conflict, if you like. Firstly, Jesus' way of love inevitably creates conflict. Right? If we're following Jesus, we're going to cause conflict. If we're not causing conflict, we might not be following Jesus. Interesting that Jesus is very intentional about the conflict, right? We said that when Mark's account of Jesus cleansing the temple has Jesus coming into the temple after entering Jerusalem, looking around, and then he goes, oh, it's getting late, and he goes back to the Mount of Olives, and then he comes back tomorrow and cleanses the temple. In John's account, it says he goes to the temple, and then he weaves a whip. Now, I don't think Jesus used that whip violently. He's using it to clear people out. But that's pretty intentional. He weaves a whip. This isn't just a reaction. This isn't just emotional conflict, if you like. This is intentional standing for what's right, standing for the way of love, embracing this new kind of kingdom. So Jesus creates conflict. Now, the point is, I guess, it's easy to create conflict, but can we create the right kind of conflict, the right kind of trouble, if you like? Can we create conflict whilst never hating our enemies, whilst never dehumanizing our enemies, while never letting go of the way of love? And I have had a personal, well, let me tell you a little bit of my journey with this, because when I was a lot younger than I am today, so back in my early 20s, I was convinced the only way to change the world, the only way that power will hand over power, the only way that rich people will let go of wealth and power is through armed struggle. Che Guevara was my hero. As a medical student, I went to Nicaragua to help support the Sandinista revolution. They recently got into power. Through armed struggle, and yet something about that, and I was in a very not good place spiritually at this time either. But something about that sort of didn't seem right. It didn't. There's something about it that seemed like how can the means justify the end? I mean, looking at so many. Revolutionary movements that have good intention end up themselves becoming oppressive. And that was already beginning to happen in Nicaragua. And through some various sources and connections, I read a book by James Cone called Malcolm and Martin in America. And it was talking about all sorts of things, but in particular, Dr. Martin Luther King's approach to civil rights, to social change through nonviolence. And I was just sort of captivated by it. And the thought that, and it also coincided with a kind of a spiritual renewal on my part, a coming to Jesus, if you like, and realizing that this sounds so much like Jesus, what he was talking about. But it comes at such great cost. Because it's like you're walking into danger. You're walking into Jerusalem. You're walking into a whole bunch of not living a way of love. You're walking into a whole bunch of violence. But it seems that Dr. Martin Luther King and his mentors and, you know, people who went before him, like Howard Thurman, they seem to get this reality that, okay, we could fight and just impose a new rule where now we're on top and other people are on the bottom. Or we have the opportunity to seek healing of mankind, healing of humankind, healing of the whole world. We're going to, if you like, participate in saving the whole world. We think of Jesus as the savior of the world. Well, Jesus is inviting us into that kind of mission by bringing a different way. And they made sacrifices and were very aware, I think, certainly King was very aware that he's not going to see that reality. He's not going to see the completion of all that, but it's people like you and me continuing that work on. Jesus' way of love is not a new kind of domination. We've seen that play. We see this played out all the time, as I mentioned. I mean, in going back to the Nicaragua example, Daniel Ortega, who was the leader of the Sandinistas in the 70s and became leader of the nation in 79, is now the president and one of the most oppressive, abusive, dictatorial presidents that there's ever been. I mean, perhaps not as bad as the Somoza dictatorship, but on a par. And it's just, it's like how, it's Animal Farm, right? I mean, how do we avoid that? How do we just stop this cycle? And remember, when Jesus is talking to the Jewish people, they've just had centuries of cycles of empire. The Assyrians, and then they get their butt kicked by the Babylonians, and then by the Persians, and then it's the Greeks, and then it's the Romans, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do we break this cycle of violence? And it's by not introducing another dominant culture. Whatever, as we think about all the things that we're dealing with right now, we have to do it through love. We have to do it through without dehumanizing the other. Now, it doesn't mean, therefore, backing off and not doing anything. It means conflict. It means speaking out, standing up. It means marching. It means voting. It means holding our ground at times. It means advancing ground at times. All that difficult stuff. It's not passive in any sense, but it has to be love. And I think that's such a challenge for us in this present moment. Jesus' way of love is total vulnerability. That's the problem, I think. That's the problem, because it begs the question, are we willing to live that way? Are we willing to take a nonviolent approach, a loving approach, when we're surrounded by people who are not doing that? I mean, are we willing to go into Jerusalem, if you like? Because we might end up getting crucified. And actually, going back to the apocalyptic passage, a bunch of people got crucified. A bunch of people got thrown to the lions. A bunch of people got burnt alive. I mean, I don't want to dramatize that or use it to make some kind of point. The point, all I'm trying to say is, it's not easy, and it's probably going to mean suffering, and it's probably going to mean having to stand in the face of darkness and feeling like the darkness has at times consumed us. That's what Jesus did. Jesus went into all that darkness. And it wasn't like with a hop, a skip, and a jump and said, I'm going to win the day eventually. I don't know what Jesus knew about the future, but he goes into that holding true even to the point of death. And finally, don't give up on Jesus. Let's not give up on Jesus. I think it's so easy to give up on Jesus. And we wouldn't say that publicly, but I feel tempted to give up on Jesus every single day. In every conflict I'm in, just at a personal level, let alone political or social, I want to resort to fear and control and power because I know how to deal with that. I'm an expert at it. But to the way of vulnerability, the way of love, it's so hard. So I want to give up many times. And as I said, I read these passages and look at these passages, I feel, Jesus, I'm so far away from you. And yet, because this is the spirit of Christ we're talking about now, I don't feel alienated. I don't feel ashamed. I feel ashamed a bit at times, if I'm honest. But I don't feel rejected. I feel that invitation into something. And the promise, not that everything's going to be okay. I think at times I've said that to my kids, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. No, everything is not going to be okay. And Jesus is not saying, don't worry, everybody, it's all going to be okay. What he's saying is, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be with you in that. As we look at the horrendous nature of our culture, the horrendous nature of the world, and everything that may be falling down on top of us, let's not give up, but see ourselves as part of an answer, part of a future that we may not see. But if we give up on it, the future is inevitable. The cycle of violence is inevitable. But if we can hold true, Jesus is saying, I'm with you in that. You'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. I'm with you. And I can lead you into something different, something more beautiful. That's your gift to the world. We're going to celebrate communion now. We say that, don't we? Celebrate communion. We're sort of we're remembering Jesus' death. This is the last meal. We'll look at this in more detail next week when Ruth talks about the death of Jesus. But the Last Supper that's about to come up, where Jesus celebrates the Passover meal with his friends. And he talks about his impending death. And it's really interesting that one of the few things that we've retained historically would be this celebration of Jesus' death, this really sad moment. And I think it's because that's kind of the cross is this symbol of all that's wrong with humanity, of all that's crushing and destructive, and yet through that suffering, incredible life can come, incredible beauty, as Jesus walks through it in love and releases a deeper magic that can transform the world. So we're today, as we celebrate communion, I don't really want to say anything more about communion other than it's this opportunity to identify with Jesus in that sadness, in that vulnerability, as he stands there looking out over Jerusalem. We could say, perhaps, and I hope this doesn't sound corny, but thank you for being with us, Jesus, but we're with you. We're with you. We're going to stand with you on that mountain looking out over Jerusalem. And we don't know what's coming our way, but we're going to be faithful. We're going to be true. That's our opportunity this morning. We have time to light a candle for Ukraine, to write out prayers, to just sit and reflect in our seats. We can move around. There's some other candles at the back we can light as a symbol of prayer, a symbol of hope. So let's just respond in the way that feels appropriate for us right now. And if that means just staying in your seat, as I said, please feel free to do that. But otherwise, we've got communion bread and gluten-free crackers and fruit juice at the front and in the middle, and you can take some, take it back to your seat, or take it with one another around the table. Let's just pray. Jesus, thank you that you are so faithful. May your presence that you promised, that is all around us right now and deep within us, Lord, may it bring us alive with courage, with hope, with love. We ask this in your name. Amen.